There's a river flowing in my soul. There's a river flowing in my soul, and it's telling me that I'm somebody. There's a river flowing in my soul.
In the first part of our conversation with Ray, he takes us back to adolescence, a young person with real aspirations but no clear map. Someone who saw school as a place of possibility while carrying family responsibility, economic pressure, and the uncertainty of life in a mixed status household. The central idea is trust, but not trust as an instant feeling. Ray shows us trust as something built through consistency. Mrs. Reyes stayed present from his sophomore year through graduation. She offered opportunities, but she also asked questions, listened without judgment, understood what a first-generation college decision might mean for Ray's family, and helped Ray reinterpret experiences once carried as shame into sources of identity and strength. In an earlier episode, episode 3, John King described a teacher, Mr. Osterweil, who made John's classroom safe, nurturing and challenging during an extraordinary difficult period in John's childhood, and said that without that teacher, he probably would not be alive today. Mrs. Reyes played a related role for Ray, a steady adult presence who made school safer, enlarged the future he could imagine, and paired care with real, demanding opportunity. As you listen, notice how practical the relationship is. It includes a summer experience, college guidance, help with an application, and connections to resources. Those actions carry weight because continuity, cultural understanding, psychological safety, and a person who sees both need and possibility hold them together. Ray then begins to translate this experience into the communities and schools model that he now is responsible for. The site coordinator is both presence and navigator, someone who builds a real relationship and who also knows how to connect school and community resources. That is very different from handing a young person a list of programs. Our first conversation with Ray leaves us with three questions for our own settings. Who has enough time and continuity to earn trust? Who sees what young people carry beyond the visible school day? And who takes responsibility for making services feel like one coherent support rather than a series of doors a family or youth has to open alone? Our second conversation asks what happens when the relational idea is tested at scale. Ray turns to the evidence on communities and schools, including a rigorous long-term study linking sustained participation in communities and schools to higher graduation rates, more post-secondary enrollment, and higher earnings later in life. But Ray does not treat the numbers as proof that services alone produce change. He returns to the mechanism underneath them. Train caring adults who personalize support, coordinate resources, and notice when a student is falling through the cracks and helps restore connection and possibility. From there, our conversation widens from attendance and performance to engagement itself. A student can be physically present and still feel unknown, disconnected, or unconvinced that school matters. Ray describes a free engagement survey built to help schools hear directly from students about emotional, social, behavioral, and cognitive engagement, whether they feel known, trust adults, experience belonging, and see value in what they are learning. Ray also makes cultural responsiveness concrete. It is not simply a statement of respect. It means having adults who understand the bridges families are being asked to cross. Adults who can speak credibly about the first generation experience, about community realities, and the fears and hopes attached to major decisions. Our second conversation with Ray closes with his bridge metaphor. The goal is not to help a few young people become better tightrope walkers. The goal is to build a bridge from fragmented support and uncertain opportunity to a stable path through school, post-secondary education, work, and adult life. A bridge made of trusted relationships, coordinated resources, and support that does not disappear when things get hard. Two questions to carry forward. What outcomes would we see if relationships and coordination were treated as the core educational infrastructure? And what would we need to measure to know whether young people are truly connected, not merely present? So let's go to a wonky direction. I want to unpack it in terms of the human component of it. So over the last year, there was a really important study that Benjamin Goldman and Jamie Gracie published that did an econometric analysis of the long-term effects of the CIS model. And it showed, among other things, that 3 years of exposure to CIS increased high school graduation by 5.2%, 2 year college enrollment by 9.1%, and earnings at age 27 by 4.3%. And one could imagine that if one continued to follow out another 10 years, one would see how those things would play out as well. The researchers concluded that the resources became effective when a trusted adult, Mrs. Reyes, analyzes and coordinates with people like young Ray. You experienced that relationship on both sides as a student and as a leader of CIS. Can you add to that in terms of what is the secret sauce that I know CIS does not want to be secret, not only about CIS, but about the potentiality of good coordinated integrated services like CIS?
Yeah, let me jump off of that last point about the idea of this really not being as the movements are. We've been 5 decades into this. This isn't about expanding one organization. And I say to many folks who will listen that CIS is a proof point, but it is not the point when it comes to what it is we're all trying to accomplish when we think about this should be a service and a person and a trained, caring adult in every Title I school. Let's start there. Every high poverty school that needs it. And the tremendous thing about the research is it begins to extrapolate what that could look like. Today, communities and schools and many other providers of what we think we call high quality evidence-based integrated student supports, which is the model that we provide, if you put all of us together, I think there is roughly 5,000 schools that are being served by an integrated student support service model of community schools or communities in school like CIS. There are 60,000, 70,000 Title I schools across the US. So clearly, we're very much only scratching the surface. And what the study puts into perspective of really thinking about this less as just what can the service of a caring adult working on non-academic issues do to boost academic scores or improve graduation rates? It wants to ask the question of what will it do for economic mobility, earnings over a lifetime? For students who have had exposure to CIS, and not just students that are being case managed, but an entire school campus. What is it? What are the impacts 10 to 20 years down the road because there is a student, there's a caring adult like a CIS site coordinator building relationships back in and coordinating services so those students who are falling through the cracks are finding the resources that they need. And the headlines, again, we're excited about the improvements that we see around graduation by 5% or 2 year college enrollment increases by 9.1%. But what was most striking for us is we had always seen ourselves as a K through 12 education intervention. And the results around what are the earnings of students who have gone to a CIS school compared to a non-CIS school at the age of 27, That's a 4.3% difference in earnings when measured at 27. And the team at Opportunity Insights at Harvard have access to administrative data to follow and track anonymized tax records. And that's a difference of close to $1,100 that you are earning just because you went to a CIS school. That's the difference, David, about being unemployed or being employed. And if you extrapolate that over a lifetime, those are close to $75,000 in an earning and lifetime difference. That's the difference between being a motivated and productive and engaged community member, citizen, career-minded. And you think, is it because they passed a test? Probably not as much as it was this sort of connection to a caring adult, the resilience build, the trust in others, a sense of belonging. And that's what the study tries to put into context as well. It measures lifetime earnings. It talks about economic mobility 10 or 12 years, 20 years later for a CIS student. But it says that if we are just measuring test scores, then we are not actually capturing what we think is the most likely predictor for long-term outcomes. So when we think about short-run outcomes, being able to pay attention to attendance, being able to pay attention to behavior, become just as animating to predicting whether that student is going to go off to graduate high school, to go into post-secondary, and to earn more. So all of a sudden, this idea of bringing a relationship back into school through a trained site coordinator, connecting with students of highest need in high poverty schools, becomes a real tool for economic mobility, for answering a question of what is driving opportunity and access and driving access to the American dream. And that's what was most exciting for us. And as the CEO of the organization, you don't want to put your organization at risk by opening yourself up to third-party evaluations, sometimes because you're worried about what the results will show. Maybe it'll show no effect. Maybe there is no difference in graduation rates or attendance scores or in earnings over a lifetime. But it was a responsibility that we've had as an organization that's been around as long as we have been, and at the scale that we're operating now, close to 30 states serving 2 million students. And I think that's what attracted the attention of these economists at Opportunity Insights, led by Raj Chetty, who studies this. And they were curious about CIS because of two things. They said, "We like you all because you're old and because you're big." And so we took those as compliments and said, "Let's share our data with you, and I'd love to know where our students are 10 or 20 years later and find out what this can tell us about the real impacts of expanding this all across the country."
I should add here that as someone who's had the good fortune to both advise at some points and then work with CIS, one of the things that has impressed me has always been from my first contact with CIS, which is around the time that you were in high school, is not wanting to run away from data, but rather wanting to use data to get better. Okay, that, and as someone who had been asked to evaluate, I never felt any pressure to do anything other than to call it as it is so that CIS could learn. And I think that's an important me message to people that data is your friend, including negative data sometimes. And again, people will hear about that when we listen to Cleveland next in the subsequent episode, because the person who led Cleveland, who I know you've met, Ray, Eric Gordon, from the beginning was somebody who would not run away from a negative statistic, but rather embrace it because it was the way of moving forward. And in this case here, Rob Chetty, who's done such wonderful work in terms of understanding the impacts of the environments that people are afforded, whether they're positive or negative, choosing to do the work on CAS is really important. Let me move to one of the issues you raised in your conversation, which is it's not just about the test score. And again, in this case here, I've been interviewing someone whose organization I've worked with a lot, okay? And I had the good fortune to be asked by CIS to work with CIS to develop an engagement survey during COVID, but with the notion that it was not just about engagement during COVID, but rather long term. It wasn't about increasing test scores, it was to really look at what's underneath attendance and grades and to understand whether or not young people felt cognitively engaged emotionally engaged, socially engaged, not just whether or not we could say they were in school. And so if you want to talk about the lessons of the engagement survey, but really the underlying organizational theory behind why the focus is on engagement, just like the focus is on developmental relationships.
And that is the distinction and the departure in our minds of what we were trying to do that was distinct and new with that engagement survey. David, I appreciate all of the ways that you think about measuring what can be captured because we get so caught up in the education world about what is sometimes the easiest elements to measure. And we force students to take these tests because we think it's going to measure an important metric. And it can be important. And I don't think want to dismiss that. But what I think we were really attracted to was there is a time, 10, 20 years, even from where we sit today, where we will be better evaluators of a student's full experience, of a whole child's connection and belonging. And what we said is that there's essentially in those surveys four domains that we want to really understand. What is the emotional engagement? How does the student feel like they belong? Are there adults in this on campus that care about me? Do you feel connected? And we want the student's voice to answer those questions. And so it is not an easy thing to deploy a survey with students. And that is the real vehicle opportunity that communities and schools has with an expansive network working with 300,000 students in a case-managed way, over 2 million students, but really picking and choosing a few of those students so that we can have deeper relationships with or deeper conversations with these engagement surveys. And so it was about emotional engagement, social engagement, behavioral. And then the fourth discipline was around cognitive engagement. Do you see value in school? Do you feel motivated? Is what you're investing your time in worth the learning? These are drop-down menus that we don't ever get to see unless you ask students and they are willing to share with you. And so we did that at a pretty broad scale. And what I think was most important is that administrative data is important, things like attendance, discipline, test scores, but it doesn't tell us if a student feels known, whether they trust adults, or whether they believe schools matter. And that's what we wanted to really begin to test the theory on for us about, is there a new way to evaluate along these four domains how a student feels connected? And if it gives students an opportunity to use their own voice to describe their own experience, even better for us to realize what are the tools to really capture the kind of experience we need to of our students. And measure categories of growth, measure categories of where we need to go deeper in with our young people. But basically, if that's a sample size of 10 or 15 on a campus, or if it is a repeatable pattern that the recognition is clear for that school principal or that school leader.
Let me go back to Mrs. Reyes, who I think probably helped ensure the fact that you kept your cognitive engagement and were socially engaged and were emotionally engaged in a meaningful way so that your time in school mattered. But she also helped you imagine possibilities you talked about, that sometimes young people in places like South San Antonio are discouraged from pursuing. At the same time, she understood something about being a first-generation college student that others who don't have that lived experience may not have. What makes support culturally responsive in practice? Meaning not just that we want to be culturally responsive, but culturally responsive so that Array will experience it. That so your parents, if they were meeting with Mrs. Reyes, would experience it.
Yeah, I think there is a way that we think about the kind of relationship that is possible with the kids that we work with, the students we are connecting and engage with, that is pulling from a place of skepticism, a place of a bridge to have to cross to trust. And the way to shorten that oftentimes is to feel like you've got leaders, adults in their lives who have crossed similar bridges themselves, who understand the cultural context of what is it going to be like to talk to Ray's parents and try to convince them? Again, neither of my parents made it past the eighth grade, the conception of college, and then the idea of talking to Ray's parents about him moving across the country to a school they've never heard of, it is difficult on its easiest day. But Mrs. Reyes was the first in her family to have gone off to college, had this conversation with her own parents, and was relating that back to what it felt to be away from home, missing her mom's cooking. And that kind of connection to my parents, that kind of connection to me, that this is somebody who gets me, and a way that you think about scaling that across a diverse network of 5,000 CIS staff like Mrs. Reyes, is that's a different conversation in the hollers of Appalachia in West Virginia, and it's a different one in an urban context in Atlanta. And being able to pull from the community and finding people who have had these experiences, who are committed to the mission and want to really connect with students, has been just the greatest. You talked about secret sauce, the greatest advantage that we have been able to explore. And so, to get back to your question around how do you deploy surveys and get authentic answers from students, it's that these students actually, these are all conversation starters. And these students want to open up about these questions that they've never explored in their own minds. And if you offer it as a conversation starter, if you offer it as, I just want to imagine, I want you to imagine yourself and where you are next year and what do you need to get there? We're not having those conversations with anybody else in our lives at the time. And our parents, with the capacity or the time or the sort of intellectual insights to have these conversations with their kids, sometimes isn't transacting. To see that and find that with a Mrs. Ray is and somebody who knows your context, your culture, your community. Yeah, I do my best to try to give you an answer to that question that is based in some real life experiences. And I could go across the board with the site coordinators who I talk to and the alumni who have gone through CIS, some of them saying to me that I am the adult today because of the adult I needed from Mrs. Johnson, Mrs. Rashida. And it's an incredible thing because these people still remember that experience of being asked these kinds of questions for the first time.
I can imagine that when people sometimes do something that I've seen trainers do, close your eyes, imagine you're back in school, and think about who is that person who really mattered to you. The number of people who are imagining the Mrs. Reyes, the Miss Rashidas, is probably great. It's not the only. And I think that what I've seen CIS do is not try to supplant the teacher, as you said. It addresses the fact that the teacher would like to do more. By reducing pressure on that teacher, it may also make it possible for that teacher also to have more quality time and more supportive time with young people. Let me end our conversation with something else that I've heard you say. It's the metaphor you brought up already in terms of that bridge and the fact that shortening the bridge, okay? But you've said that CIS should not merely help a few exceptional young people become better tightrope walkers. It should help build a well-protected bridge so that everyone gets across, that everyone, I'm just adding, would be able to thrive. So I'd invite you to expand on your bridge metaphor.
Yeah, what I believe is necessary is we're thinking about the future of our work at communities and schools. We think about ourselves as a very large nonprofit that is managing an army of 5,000 people. So in many cases, we're a large HR organization. We just happen to be deployed inside schools. And it is very hard to get a permission slip as a nonprofit to get access inside a school, to get access to school data, to be in exchange conversations with teachers and principals, and have space on a school campus. There is a world where we think about the future of our work and integrated student supports to be not an innovation or to be an add-on. And if you think about building those bridges and bringing relationship back into school, there is a transition period that we need to come into where a principal or a superintendent today is looking at their options. They're looking at the challenges that schools have fallen into the vacuum of having to solve for. whether those are housing instability, food insecurity, mental health crisis, rising issues with abuse or substance abuse, a kind of a mental health crisis that it has family members disconnected or finding and reeling from crisis. Schools are being asked to be the village, and they've been asked to be the village as it's broken apart over the last half century more and more because the need has shown up more and more. So back to the principal, they've got three options. I could build the system myself. We think there's a path for that. We think that all schools should implement and be funded to support high quality integrated student supports with a staff member who is deploying it. We've seen that through efforts and coalitions around community schools. At CIS, we see that continue as we think about the expansion of our work. But this really needs to be a permanent fixture of public education. And if we believe that the science of learning and development has caught up with the concepts of what developmental relationships do to variable learners and their experience, it should be very clear to us that this is no longer a nice to have. This is a must have in every, at least Title I school that is eligible in the country. And behind that is not a philanthropic solution. Behind that really is a state and federal level solution to think about building those bridges of people, that it is an army that needs to be in this effort. And that means that army is not standing on the sidelines. Schools of higher ed who are training and certified teachers probably need to be thinking through their strategy to train and certify these professionals who are able to work in a school, able to work outside of a school with community metrics and understand the differences between the housing authority and the food bank and the mental health specialist and all of the work it takes to bring them inside schools. Then we're living up to that vision of what our founder many years ago was describing, which is it's not programs that transform young people's lives, it's relationships. And if there's a 100-year plan, it's a sign us up effort because we're really focused on the coalition that it's going to take to build this. It isn't about expanding one organization. There are too many requirements of our young people to be tightrope walkers, and we need to be very clear about building that strong bridge to the people that we build and embed inside schools.
Thank you very much, Ray, and thank you very much, Mrs. Reyes, who in part enabled Ray to be here today.